Welcome to the second colloquium of the week. Today we're pleased to have Keith Moffat. He got his PhD in Cambridge University and I guess has been there for most of the time since with a brief sojourn at Bristol University. And currently he's an emeritus professor at Cambridge. He has won too many honors and awards for me to even begin to list. What I think is the most recent one is the David Crichton Medal from the IMA and London Mathematical Society. And today he's going to tell us about relaxation under topological constraints and the breaking of the constraints.
Is there a pointer or a...
We have the hockey stick.
Oh, the hockey stick. Yes. That's fine. That's wonderful.
Yeah, we could probably get you a
Well, thank you very much for these kind words of introduction, and thank you, Neil, for allowing me to come to this wonderful institute, which I've heard so much about. And I have to say right away that I am not a cosmologist. I work in that complex intermediate zone of everyday life, and I work in fluid mechanics particularly. And I want to tell you about a problem that I've been involved in together with some colleagues in Cambridge, particularly Ray Goldstein, who is a wonderful experimentalist. His wife, Adriana Pesci, a former student of mine, Renzo Rica, who's now in Milan. James McTavish is an undergraduate who came in on this as an undergraduate project. And Herbert Huppert, long-time colleague who works in geophysical fluid dynamics. So that's the team. It's a gradually growing team. All the work started about 4 or 5 years ago. Now, my motivation comes from a subject called dynamo theory, which is a bit nearer to cosmology, I guess, because it deals with the origin of magnetic fields in astrophysics out there in the cosmos. And there was a famous paper written by this famous Soviet physicist, Zeldovich, whose centenary is being celebrated this year, centenary of his birth. He died 1987, but he was a marvelous man. And he wrote a paper back in 1972, and he sort of conceived of what was described as the stretch, twist, fold mechanism for the fast dynamo. It's very simple. It's like taking an elastic band in the form of a circle and imagine you simply stretch it to twice the radius and fold it over and fold it back on itself. So you've got a double covering of a circle and the tension in the elastic has obviously increased. And in a similar way, the magnetic field intensity increases by a factor of 2 if you do this. The energy goes up by a factor of 4. And then you imagine repeating this, iterating again and again and again, and you get something like an exponential increase of magnetic field. I've said here, actually, that there's a whole book being written on this topic, the stretch, twist, fold, the fast dynamo, as it's called, by Stephen Childress at the Courant Institute. And Andrew Gilbert, who was a former student of mine in Cambridge, book published 1995. I've said there is a twist, a complication, which means that actually a dynamo of this kind can't exist for reasons that I might be able to explain. But anyway, I was interested in the mechanism and I wrote a paper with another former student, Michael Proctor, in 1985 with this title, The Topological Constraints Associated with Fast Dynamo Action. And we were concerned with this stretch, twist, fold mechanism, as you see. And one of the difficulties, it's easy enough to imagine it and describe it in this way, but to imagine that embedded in a fluid and to devise a velocity field at every point of the fluid that will give you this effect and give it repeatedly, iterate it, is not by any means straightforward. We made a first attempt at this and the velocity components of the field we were analyzing at that time are shown here, and I just draw your attention to the fact that there is a stretching and a rotation effect here, and then there are nonlinear terms here and here and here, which represent twisting and folding. And it's not terribly easy to, well, it's easy to write down a field of this kind and then analyze its properties. And one of the problems with that was it was unbounded for large x, y, z. So not a very satisfactory velocity field. But in a later paper, Conrad Beyer and I managed to modify that velocity field and put it inside a sphere. And this is a flow in a sphere on which the tangential velocity field is prescribed on the boundary. And it drives a flow, actually a solution of the Stokes equations for slow creeping flow in the interior. This is often what happens in our subject. You start off with a problem like dynamo theory and you end up doing something entirely different. This is understanding the problem, the phenomenon of chaos in a steady three-dimensional Stokes flow. Turned out this flow is in general chaotic, and what you see is actually a single streamline of the flow here for a particular choice of parameters. This is the velocity field, a sum of two. One, a very simple velocity field, rotation, and the other complicated with the nonlinear terms. But now it fits inside a sphere. The normal component of velocity is zero on the surface. The tangential component is non-zero. And this is the flow that is driven. When I say this is the flow, it's a single streamline, which you imagine goes round and round and on and on and on. And each time it crosses a particular diametral plane, you record the position of the crossing. So it's pretty obvious we're dealing with a chaotic velocity field here. This is one of the properties. And whether this type of velocity field will act as a dynamo or not is as yet unknown. I believe it can, but it's something that still has to be done. Now, just to set a little bit more an alternative context, I just show you this picture. It's a rather beautiful picture from one of the satellite observations of an erupting magnetic field from the solar surface. The photosphere is down around here. And this was a particular eruption that took place in May 2002. The rise, 10 minutes of eruption. It had traveled 80,000 kilometers. So this is a very dramatic burst of energy, and there is an obvious twist there, which I'll come back to, and then the plasma flows back down to the solar surface along the magnetic lines of force. So this is actually a magnetic field that you're seeing here, twisting round and back to the solar surface. And the foot points on the solar surface are rather, we think of them as pinned. They tend to move with the movement of the on the photosphere that is induced by what's going on below the surface. Okay, it's stretch, twist, fold that is the sort of geometrical mechanism that is of interest. Now, of course, you can go backwards and unfold, untwist, and unstretch, which is like relaxing. There is something called the Rithe for a curve of this kind, and if you imagine that flattened onto a plane, then you see just one crossing, and that is actually the measure of the Rithe. The Rithe is equal to one. And when you unfold and untwist back to a single circle, there is no crossing now, and the Rithe is zero. There is a theorem in differential geometry that tells you that Rithe plus twist is constant, is an invariant. The twist is a little more, it involves the torsion of that curve, but it also involves an internal component, internal twist. You really do have to think of that not as a single curve, but as a tube or possibly as a ribbon, which can have twist. And it's the Rithe plus twist that is conserved. So going from here to here, you lose Rithe, but you must gain a corresponding amount of twist in the tube. And that is one of the interesting little complications. Likewise here, if you start with an untwisted circle, zero Rife. You had a Rife equal one here, so a twist must be minus one. So again, there is a twist in this, just in order to compensate that Rife. So these sort of considerations are quite interesting. Well, we thought it was maybe difficult to embed this motion in a full fluid, but what we could do is study this, a surface, a sort of intermediate step, study a surface spanning this wire. If I take the, imagine we take a wire in this form and dip it into a soap solution and draw it out of the soap solution. Well, in general, you find a soap film that covers this, but it also covers this little bit here. And you can prick the large disc area, leaving only the soap film here, which is obviously in the form of a Möbius strip. And this is quite intriguing, the idea of a one-sided soap film or non-orientable soap film. And then the question is, suppose we had that Möbius strip soap film and we take the wire and very gently and very slowly untwist, unfold back to a circle. What happens to that one-sided surface? I mean, this is a fun problem. And again, we're well away from dynamo theory, but you see the steps that take you to consideration of a problem of this kind and the possibility of doing a nice experiment in the laboratory to see exactly what happens. Now, I've put here the parametric equations of an untwisting wire, x, three components, x, y, z, functions of two parameters, t and s. T is time, and s is just a parameter going round the closed curve from 0 to 2 pi. So as time advances, when time is 0, it would be really closed, completely closed on itself. So I've taken a small time, 0.1, in normalized, so it becomes 1 out here. And when it's small, you've got the Möbius strip. And as time advances, you move out in this way. So we have a sort of mathematical starting point for the problem. Dip the wire in soap solution to make a one-sided Möbius strip, soap film, and unfold what happens. That was the question. And we weren't the first to ask this question. It was asked by no less than Richard Courant, after whom the Courant Institute is named, in about 1940 this was. He wrote this paper, Soap Film Experiments with a Minimal Surface. Of course, a great mathematician, but also he was obviously intrigued by problems of this kind and little laboratory demonstrations, and he has a very attractive graduate student there helping him with this work. And in this informal article, Courant mentions that a one-sided soap film in the form of a Möbius strip is easily formed and that it can jump to a two-sided film if the wire is, the boundary is suitably distorted. I didn't actually know about this work when we started on it, but anyway, it was the experiment that we decided to do, and we discovered this article later on. Before I do that, I just say that this is, in a way, it fits into a very old tradition in mathematics. The famous two-wire problem dates back to Euler and Lagrange, both very famous names in fluid mechanics and in mathematics generally. And that's just if you take two circular wires and you have the soap film that is bounded by these wires, the you have a catenoid. You can separate the two circles along the axis. And at a certain critical separation, the catenoid ceases to exist. It just doesn't exist anymore if they're too far apart. In fact, what happens, I'll show you in a moment, the catenoid collapses onto the axis at the center and splits into two disks. The reason for that is, roughly speaking, as far as I don't know if you can, if this, these curves come out clearly, but there is, for any separation of the two wires, there's actually a family of catenoids, a one-parameter family of catenoids that are bounded by the wires. And one of these has minimum energy in this situation. There's a minimum here of the curve. And the other has a maximum energy and is obviously unstable. So there is one unique stable solution in this situation. And as you increase the separation, parameter B, the separation between the two wires, this curve evolves towards the inflection type curve here. This is the critical situation. Well, actually, this is just beyond when B is 0.7, in fact. That is the critical value. Beyond that, there is no minimum, and therefore there is no solution of the having a catenoid structure. Is that visible? Are these curves visible at the back? Not sure. No. Sorry about that. Well, we'd have to put the lights out, but don't worry. You take my word for it. It's a curve with two, a minimum and maximum that come together in one of these typical bifurcation situations. Well, look at this. This is the catenoid. And actually, we did this experimentally. You can do it in various ways. We decided to do it by taking the two wires and rotating one of them a little bit. And again, there's a critical where it jumps. And the surface, you can't get quite, but roughly speaking, it's a catenoid, a slightly distorted catenoid. And you see how it's collapsing because there is no steady solution. And it forms that singularity in the interior, a thread-like singularity, which splits up for fluid dynamical reasons and gives you one dominant droplet and various other drops as well. Let me show you it again if I can. It's rather beautiful, really. There's a sort of trampoline effect where when this one bounces off the lower film. Now you've got two discs. I think actually the upper disc has burst. But in principle, there are two discs. It's called the Goldstein solution, obviously a trivial solution for the minimum area problem. Well, that's the classical problem. And there you're not dealing with one-sided surface. All these surfaces are two-sided. Here's another example. You can have a disc. You can have two catenoids and a disc soap film joining them, and that's quite easily produced in the laboratory. And then you have an angle of 120 degrees. There are three of these. And when it's in equilibrium, 120 degrees, you've got a static equilibrium, but as soon as it starts to collapse, it collapses because these angles are no longer in equilibrium. Right, for the Möbius soap film problem now, if we turn to that, the one-sided film, we get a clue from the family of ruled surfaces. And here I've given it x as a function of parameters s and mu. T should be in there as well, because t is still the time parameter. Mu is now, well, if you draw a straight line, you take the surface here, and imagine you simply draw a straight line normal to one of the almost circles to the other part. All the way around, you draw that straight line. And as the line goes around, you've got the ruled surface, which is easily given in this parametric form. And so mu is a parameter on the straight line that goes from minus 1 to plus 1. And the center line, mu equals zero, is always a circle of radius 1 minus t in the plane z equals zero. Well, the clue that you get is that the topology of this ruled surface changes in the sense that the hole disappears somewhere between 0.6 and 0.8. And actually, it is at exactly 2/3, 0.66. And local analysis of the ruled surface shows that a twisted fold forms at the boundary at this time, t equals 2/3, and then seems to sort of, as you increase t further, it gives the impression of propagating towards the center of the circle for t greater than 2/3. And the surface is self-intersecting for t greater than 2/3 in a neighborhood of this fold. And it's obvious that the real soap film can't sustain this sort of structure. So something else has to happen. Of course, the soap film is not a ruled surface. It's not got these straight lines on it. It's curved like the catenoid. It's got a smaller area than the ruled surface. Another way of looking at this is as T goes from just less than two-thirds to just later, that you see the disappearance of the hole, that particular projection looking at the wire. It's a projection of the surface near to the wire for values of T in that neighborhood. The hole disappears at the critical time when the cusp in the boundary curve is apparent. That's a cusp in a particular projection. And at the instant T equals two-thirds, the wire actually has locally the form of a twisted cubic. It's a curve with parameters T, T squared, T cubed. And at a later instant, and it's actually at time T equals four-fifths, the wire has an inflection point, point of zero curvature. At a particular point, it's S equals zero going around the curve. And at this instant, something funny happens. You know, at an inflection point, the Frenet triad on the curve can flip through an angle of a pi because the normal, effectively, the principal normal changes direction as you go through the inflection point. The total torsion along the wire jumps. There is a singularity as you go through this inflection point. The torsion jumps by plus or minus one, and that's compensated by a jump in the internal twist that I mentioned, if you think of it as a tube or a ribbon. This shows, actually, for that parameterization, the curvature C on the curve as a function of the parameter S and of time, T. So a two-dimensional picture, and you see the dip here, where it dips in a very sharp point, actually. And at the point S equals zero, the curvature goes to zero and then rises again. It's defined to be positive, but there's a definite zero at time T equals four-fifths. That reminds me of this, which is a lovely demonstration for students. Really Zeldovich's belt trick. It's best done with a webbing belt. And you see, if I twist it through an angle, I think pi, and fold it like that, then you've got a nice writhe equal one situation. And you can imagine a vertical vector on this wire. And you ask, how does that vertical vector change direction as you go from my right hand to my left hand? In this position, it's constant. It's always pointing north, up. But now, if I slowly move out, then when I get to this situation, that vertical vector has one complete turn as you go from the right hand to the left hand. Now, at any stage in this process, the number of turns of the vertical vector is an integer. It's zero here, and it's one here. And yet this has been a slow, continuous process. And in a slow, continuous process, you've got a parameter that jumps suddenly from zero to one. And where does it jump? This is the question for students. Well, here's the answer for students. It jumps when the curve goes through its inflection point. There is necessarily a moment when that curve goes through an inflection point. The Frenet triad jumps, and it's really quite a tricky business to understand what is going on. So the questions regarding the soap film are the following. I think I'll go to the next one first and show you what actually happens. This is in real time. So this is a very crude experiment. We've made a one-sided soap film. We grip the wire with two little grippers and pull it, gradually try to unfold it. And we're very near the critical point already here. A little bit of distortion more, and it's very sudden. You see, something suddenly happens. Before that jump, it was one-sided. Now it's actually two-sided. Well, to resolve that, we've got to do it with very high-speed photography. So this is high-speed photography, 5,600 frames per second, and this is the collapse of the hole. And this is a very rapid collapse. Now, something funny happens. There's obviously a singularity on the boundary that we'd like to understand. And you see that twist, which we thought to begin with was just some kind of stray optical effect. But we saw it every time. And moreover, when this twist was finished, that twist, which is reflecting some kind of twist in the surface, remained there and seemed to be very, very robust. Of course, if we continued the unfolding and got back to a circle, then gradually that twisted loop disappears. But it's there. If we just go through the jump and leave it there, then it's, as I say, robust and it sticks for ages. I'll just go back to here to point out the questions that we wanted to answer. Firstly, where is the singularity located? Well, pretty evidently on the boundary in this case, not in the interior. With the Euler-Lagrange problem, it was in the interior. With this, it's got to be on the boundary, and we believe that now. It's inevitably on the boundary. Does the nature of the singularity depend on the topology of the film? Well, yes. The answer is going to be yes. What is the dynamical evolution of the film in the neighborhood of the singularity? Well, that's always of interest. How do you approach that singularity? What's the time dependence? And what exactly is going on? What are the right tools to describe the process? Are there mathematical tools that might be useful for this? And can we deduce general rules about the transitions? Well, we've written about this, and this was the first paper we wrote on the topic, and there have been one or two follow-up papers since then. Well, this I showed you, I'll just do it rapidly again. That's in real time. And then this is in slowed down time. That's why although your hands may be shaking, holding the, when it's so slow, everything looks beautifully steady and regular. And it forms this funny twist. And there's a better picture of the twist after the jump, this thing here, which is, of course, optical. Light is shining through this, and this is what we see. But what is it we're seeing? That is the question. Well, the fact that the wire has a finite radius is important, as it turns out. Here is the wire, and we've got a blown-up photograph, and you can see the radius, the diameter of the wire there is quite finite. The plateau border is something that it's the curve on the wire where the soap film meets the wire. The soap film is much, much thinner than the radius of the wire. So you do get a definite curve. If you continue or project the soap film onto the wire, you get a curve on the surface of the wire. And you can see it here. The light curve coming down here is the plateau border. And then it seems, you see, it comes round here. And then it disappears here, and it's gone behind the wire, and it comes out here on the other. So it is actually twisted. The plateau border is twisted round the wire. Well, what we have seen there is you jump from a one-sided film here to a two-sided film here via this sort of slowed down process where the hole, which has a diameter d, decreases as some function of time and disappears. And at the moment that it disappears, this thing appears in the surface. And what we have found is that before the jump, the plateau border indeed goes behind and comes out in front of the wire. But after the jump, it comes down and goes in front and then behind. In other words, the sense of the twist of the plateau border on the wire changes during the jump. And this seems very intriguing. As the wireframe is gradually distorted, the one-sided film transforms to a two-sided. The frames show the collapse. Twisted border, well, okay. Just after the collapse, the border is twisted around the frame in the opposite sense, as shown in the last diagram. So a change of twist from right-handed, as looked at, viewed here, to left-handed. Well, I remind you of the picture of the erupting magnetic field and our model experiment with a soap film. They look very similar. I wouldn't say any more than that. I don't want to claim, but there's something that could be possibly a little bit generic about this kind of thing, how twist can appear in physical systems when you're least expecting it. So this is what's happening. Reconnection, going from B to D, right-handed twist of the plateau border goes to left-handed twist. And this is looking at it again another way. Actually, I've got before the jump here is on the right, on the right. Now, looking at the whole wire, not just locally, but the whole wire, the plateau border actually before the jump, you see you've got over, under, over, and then under. I say over, under before the jump. There is a double linkage of the plateau border with the wire. They're doubly linked. Now, during the jump, it's this under over that changes and becomes over under. If you have two overs together, over, then it's not a link at all. You can pull the plateau border off the wire, and likewise two unders. So you get to over, under, which is this situation. And that, of course, is characteristic of a disc crossing a wire, two-sided disc spanning a wire. So this makes a sort of coherent story, that it is that jump in the twist of the plateau border that is essential to understand this. And again, what is it doing locally on the wire? If this is the wire, then you've got a surface. The surface comes in and makes contact with the wire along the plateau border. And because it's twisted, that surface, the line you're coming along, has to twist round and then reappear on this side. That's the situation I've tried to represent here. Before, you know, when you have an over-under, and after, it's an under-over, and it has changed here. And at the critical instant, the plateau border, when you're changing from one to the other, plateau border is a straight line and a circle around the wire. You see what I mean? The helix has collapsed into a circle, and then it opens out again with the opposite twist. Seems no reason why it shouldn't do that. But it's got to be a viscous effect on the wire that causes or enables this sort of transition. Then there's the question of the energy and geometry of the surfaces. And I won't say too much about that. We've got numerically obtained minimal surfaces, which are gray in these pictures. These are minimal area surfaces, whereas these are ruled surfaces, which are a pretty bad approximation. A very good approximation, actually, when you're near to the closed-up Möbius strip. Both give the same sort of energy curve as a function of the time parameter, but then they deviate, and the real behavior has a lower energy than the ruled surface behavior, and the jump occurs about here, actually before tau equals 0.5 in the experiment, real soap film experiment. The jump from one-sided to two-sided occurs at this point. And then the energy continues on its way until you have the energy of a disc spanning spanning the wire, the circular wire. Now, one can look at the more of the fluid mechanical aspect of this rather than the simple topological aspect. And we did this in terms of the diameter d. We got very accurate measure of the diameter as a function of time of the whole. And this is how it goes to zero. If tp is the collapse time, then as t approaches tp from below, you're moving in this direction. And the diameter of the whole, well, this is a log-log plot, so the diameter decreases in this way. And there appear to be two regimes, an initial regime where the diameter goes like the one-third power of this time to collapse, and then a second regime when it goes like the two-thirds power, so a more rapid collapse finally. And we believe that this is a collapse that is controlled by viscosity, mu, and the dynamics on the wire. You can construct very easily this sort of dimensionless, expression for diameter T in the right dimensions. Sigma is surface tension, which plays an important part, obviously. H is the scale of the wire, and mu the viscosity. And that does give the one-third power. So we believe it's viscous controlled at that earliest stage around here to here. But then
you could check it by, you know, repeating experiments with different thickness of the wire. Right?
We should do, and we haven't done that. And I keep trying to press my colleagues to do it with different wire radii, because this is important to check whether this is indeed correct. The two-thirds power, I think this is correct, and it's a relationship that has been found before in other collapse situations, and it involves the density of the air, rho. And it's because when you're very near the end, it's going very rapidly, the air has to be pushed out, pushed sideways out of the hole. And it's that inertia of the air that can, of course, surface tension is still driving it, but air inertia is resisting it. And it's that combination that gives a two-thirds power loss. Again, that is our belief. Yes, with different surface tensions. We should end in a vacuum, and yeah. That's right.
Did you get bubbles in vacuum?
Yes, you get all sorts of other problems in a vacuum. But that is, they're not problems that worry cosmologists. Yes, exactly. Change the pressure, change the density, that would be enough. Or do it inside a bell jar with a modest vacuum. Yeah, and there's so much to be done, really. Well, we, of course, instead of doing that, we started exploring transitions in other geometries, because really we'd like to have a theory, a general theory, for any system of wires, of linkages, of knots, and everything else. It would be fun, wouldn't it, to classify all possible topological jumps. This is the sort of problem that appeals to mathematicians. Funny thing is that mathematicians have been, I'm talking about pure mathematicians, have been concerned with the problem of the existence of minimal surfaces spanning a big given curve boundary or a system of links or knots or whatever for a century. But they haven't been concerned, or very little concerned, there are very few papers concerned with this sort of thing, jump from one minimum state to another, which involves the stability considerations. Very little on that. But this is another shape of wire, which is now, it's attracted a lot of interest in the pure mathematics literature, funny enough, this type of minimal surface. And you take a circle and you pull a tongue out, as it were, if it were elastic, and you pull the tongue back and dip it through the plane of the wire, and you get this curve. You dip it in soap solution, and you get a complicated surface coming out, and you prick if there is a film across here, you puncture it, but you're still left with an interesting film structure in the rest and coming down the tongue and moving out here, and it's all over. And then you can move the tongue forwards and backwards and see what happens. There's a lot that goes into this, a lot of thinking. This was done by Adriana Pesci, this diagram of the various ways that you can deform things and different behavior that you can get. I won't try to explain all that, but just show you what happens. So the soap film surface is initially here a one-sided section of a Klein bottle with a plane of symmetry. And you get that by taking two Möbius strips of opposite twist and stitching them together along the boundary. Not all the way. If you went all the way, then the surface would intersect itself, but you just go part of the way and you get this type of boundary. And then when the bounding wire is pulled slowly apart, the film jumps to a two-sided surface. So it's the same sort of thing again. But now we've got a plane of symmetry down the middle, and the hole will collapse. And there's a lot of fluid mechanics going on in that film, in that minimal area film, which is quite interesting in itself. But if I look at that after the jump, you can see very clearly the plateau border, which is twisted round here and twisted the opposite way on the side. There's a plane of symmetry down here, but you've had two jumps, more or less simultaneous, and two jumps, and they are of the same kind as considered previously. They certainly occur on the boundary, although we started with a one-sided film, that's it. One-sided surface, and it after the jump, it's two-sided. So that's why we believe the singularity or singularities, there are two of them, have to occur on the boundary. Now, there is fluid mechanics in this, and you can see it in the little fingering instability that appears. This is a slightly different problem. This is the problem of two circles with the two catenoids and a disc, joining them. So you start with the... And I go back again and do that again. That's in a situation where it's collapsing. And this fingering instability has occurred, and it's quite dramatic. And it's actually like fingers flowing down a soap film. This is a well-known instability when you have an inclined plane and you have a fluid that's poured onto the plane and it's advancing, viscous fluid. It forms fingering instability. But I don't think it's been observed in a soap film before. And this sort of, likewise, it's a gravitational. And there are various stages of collapse there. And we do it slightly, one can vary the conditions of this experiment, but you see the inner disc there. You pull it apart, which causes a thick film to develop, and that film then is subject to the fingering instability that you see there. So we've done a bit of analysis on that as well, and I think that paper has appeared very recently in JFM. Well, a relaxation, many physical systems have this sort of tendency to relax, to minimize their energy subject to any topological constraints that may apply. And this is perhaps an even simpler situation, a wire tied in the form of a knot. It's the figure of eight knot. Here, the figure of eight knot with four crossings, one, two, three, four. Two over, it's an alternating knot, two over crossings and two under crossings. If that is an elastic wire, well, a wire, but the kind you can bend with bending energy, then you let it relax. This is the relaxed shape of the wire. I simply suspended this by a thread and let it find its equilibrium. And now you've got two very close to each other here, two crossings over and another two here. I believe if that wire had really zero diameter, this would be a perfect coincidence here and similarly here, but that scale is controlled by the wire diameter and perhaps the other, the physical elastic properties of the wire to some extent as well. But the four crossings now occur as two double crossings in effect. And that's again an indicator, and of course the wire is making contact with itself in the minimum energy state. So that's where the topology grips and doesn't allow it to lose any more energy. You can think of much more complicated situations, and we do when it's a question of magnetic fields out there in the cosmos. You can start with any system of knotted and or linked magnetic flux tubes. The arrows here indicate the direction of the magnetic field in the tubes. And if you think of just one knotted tube, call it the knot K, of volume V carrying magnetic flux phi, then imagine this immersed in an incompressible, perfectly conducting, but viscous fluid. This is sort of tricks that we can play in magnetohydrodynamics. So perfectly conducting means that magnetic field lines are frozen in this fluid. They are transported with the fluid. Viscous means that if the fluid is moving at all, it dissipates energy. Incompressible means that the volume of the flux tube is conserved. The flux itself is conserved. That's fundamental from Maxwell's equations. So what happens in this situation? Well, it goes to well, here are the equations, and I shouldn't bother you too much with that. But the minimum magnetic energy has this form. It's a dimensionless number, m, phi squared, the square of the flux, v, volume to the minus one-third. It's the only dimensional possibility. And the m, dimensionless number, determines solely by the knot type, k. Well, I shouldn't say quite that, because more generally, you have to allow for twist of the magnetic, internal twist of the magnetic field inside the flux tube. And that can be anything, because you can imagine taking a flux tube, cut it, twist it by an arbitrary amount, and join it together again. So there's an arbitrary parameter, H, which is actually related to what we describe as the magnetic helicity, which is conserved in an ideal fluid, in a perfectly conducting fluid. And that helicity is this parameter h times phi squared. And the h is the conserved twist plus Rife that I mentioned before. So it all ties in together. And now the minimum energy, this m, can be a function of h. Depends on the amount of twist that you put in. But it's still the phi squared v to the minus one-third. And that is the simple result of relaxation. And you, the simplest situation would be a trefoil knot, for example, here, carrying flux phi and a volume V. Maxwell tension in the tube makes it shrink in length. Incompressibility makes it increase in cross-sectional radius. Obviously, there's a limit to how far you can go, and it's when it, in effect, makes contact with itself. It can't contract any further. And in that state, you've got the minimum magnetic energy. And I think with zero, well, these curves we computed some time ago, the M of H curves for different torus knots, for the trefoil knot, well, it always has a minimum. Not necessarily at H equals zero, because the knot itself has chirality, but it has a minimum, and I think it's the minimum value for the M that we've quoted up here, 32 for this configuration of the trefoil knot, and a larger value for a more complex initial configuration of the same trefoil knot. You can do it for more complex knots. There's no end of it. And this relates to a big theory that has been developing in a different community, theory of so-called ideal knots. Sometimes called just tight knots for obviously reasons. I think that's a better description. And a tight knot, it's a question of working out the energy. Given the knot, what is the minimum energy? And there's a very big activity in this area now, and very good work. Well, to end on a little bit on turbulence, you see, we think of the vortex lines in a turbulent flow as, in fact, this is a computation. This is a direct numerical simulation of turbulence at a fairly high Reynolds number, the usual Reynolds number, it would be the square of this R lambda. So it's a high Reynolds number, as high as one can go pretty well on in direct numerical simulation with a box with this number of grid points. And these are vortex tubes. It's the vortex, it's the magnitude of the vorticity, contours of magnitude of vorticity that is plotted here. And you get the impression of a great tangle of spaghetti with a lot of topological complexity. Well, you can generate this sort of thing. You can fabricate knots, a wonderful program that's available on the web by Sharine called Knotplot. And you can create knots of more or less arbitrary complexity. I just say that there's a well-known exact analogy between magnetostatics, which you get by magnetic relaxation, static configurations, and steady solutions of the Euler equations, an exact analogy. So if you find any solution of the magnetostatic equations, then you've simultaneously found a solution of the steady Euler equations. The analog of the magnetic field is the velocity field in the solution of the Euler equations. However, the analogy doesn't extend to stability, whereas the magnetic configurations are stable because they're minimum energy. The Euler solutions are not stable. They're unstable, almost inevitably. And that's one of the root causes of turbulence. So there we are. I think that summarizes what I've been saying. This is about the analogy, the difference in stability properties. Yes, the equilibria in general exhibit tangential discontinuities, like when the knot, the trefoil knot, makes contact with itself. You've got a tangential discontinuity, which is a current sheet. And the analog of the current sheet is a vortex sheet. Vortex sheets are unstable, absolutely. They turn into vortex filaments. And that's why you see all these vortex tubes in the turbulent simulation. And although they're unstable, you know that dynamical systems have a tendency to hover for a long time near points of unstable equilibrium, and suggesting that the unstable Euler flows may capture something of the structure of turbulence. I just finished with that picture, which is from an old book published 100 years ago by Darcy Thompson on growth and form, a very, very famous book on biological evolution. And he makes this statement: the most remarkable protozoan configuration, that of the ciliate infusoria. Here, the curved contour seems to enter, re-enter, and disappear within the substance of the body, so bounding a deep and twisted space or passage, which merges with the fluid contents and vanishes within the cell. And that's a rather intriguing statement made 100 years ago. You think of it as an example of topological ingenuity in molecular biology. It's not inconceivable that evolution at the cellular level depends from time to time on this sort of jump from one configuration. As it grows slowly, it gets to some unstable, and it has to jump to something completely different. It's an appealing idea. And I think biologists are rather keen to follow up on this. Well, thank you very much.
Of course, the evolution of that is you see the twist appear and then it folds in on itself. Then you have a key thing that you didn't mention in regards to the magnetic connection, and that's reconnections.
Yes.
And you get a loop that goes off. And then when you look at your plateau boundary, it wraps around, collapses the helix.
Yes.
Do you effectively get reconnection, and do you maintain a boundary loop, right? I imagine you can't because there's not a film extending off.
Well, as I say, yeah, the analogy is very weak. It's only a little bit, you know, to stimulate the imagination a little bit. But the for our soap film, that loop appears. There has been a reconnection on the wire of the plateau boundary. It is because right hand to left hand, the reflected, the twist in the surface. I don't think in the surface it reconnects in the way that your magnetic flux tubes reconnect in the, you know, up in the medium.
Oh, yes.
Well, it does. If you don't move the wires at all, yes, after the jump, you try and hold them absolutely steady,
yeah,
then it stays forever,
okay,
until the film bursts. The film may burst eventually because of slow drainage, but it stays forever. No, it disappears only when you continue the unfolding.
You talked about modeling this as a state of quasi-stationary equilibria and looking for critical points. The nice thing about a series of quasi-stationary equilibria is you can go forward and backwards.
Yes.
I noticed all of your examples started collapsed with your Mobius strip and then went forward.
Yes.
What happens if you go the other way?
Yes. You can't go the other way. In this case, that's an interesting thing. It's a one-way process. And if you start with the two-sided, okay, disk, and do the twist and the fold, it remains two-sided all the way if you do it very, very carefully. But what often happens is that the surface will touch itself in the process, you know, if you're not frightfully careful, or the wire will touch itself. If the surface touches itself, then it splits, and then it can go to the one-sided. But if you're very careful, it won't. So it is. It's not really a reversible process, I would say. Which is encouraging. It gives a sort of direction to time, doesn't it? It means that things always go one way, which is what we like to believe.
Again.